To help us get started and to provide a broad historical context of immigration in U.S. society, we're fortunate to have David M. Kennedy, currently the Donald J. McLaughlin Professor of History at Stanford. He is the co-director of the Bill Lane Center for the Study of the North American West, and we're going to ask him to give us an overview of immigration and get us started.
You are different.
Can I close this without doing damage to your program?
I lay flat.
And I'm not going to start pushing buttons here if I lay something on top. Okay. Well, my assignment is to give an historical review of what we believe we know about immigration in the past. This is a 200-year segment of history that I'll be talking about, and the organizers of this conference have generously given me 30 minutes to sum that up. But my principal purpose here is going to be to try to suggest where we can and where we can and should not take history as our guide as we confront current immigration issues. We know a great deal about that wave, enormous wave, of some 35 million European immigrants and a few hundred thousand Asian immigrants who came to this country in roughly the century from 1820 to 1920. We know a lot about why they left wherever they came from, how they got here, and what happened to them after they arrived. So I'm going to rehearse a little bit of that, what amongst historians is fairly common knowledge and conventional wisdom, by way of pointing toward the present and asking where we can and cannot, or should not, take history as a guide to what the future might hold. So I want to do this partly by way of suggesting that history as a way of thinking and knowing actually has some utility by way of guiding us to the point where we can and cannot act on precedents and where we have to confront the true novelty of our situation where it exists. And I want to do this by asking two questions twice over. They're very simple questions. First, why did people become migrants at all in the 19th and early 20th century? And then what happened to them once they got here, and what happened to this society once they arrived here? Two very, very simple questions. And then essentially I want to turn those same two questions to the present, and just to probe a little bit as to why people are migrants today, why they show up in this society in such numbers, as we're all familiar with, and what are likely to be the consequences for them and for the society at large of their presence here in such numbers. So two very, very simple questions. The first pair of questions about why did people migrate in the past and what happened once they got here, to repeat, is a subject about which we as historians know a great deal. And it's that body of knowledge that we may or may not be able to walk up to the present and to give us any guidance. Now I want to begin in what might strike you as a strange place and time and a strange voice. The place is Tunisia. The date is July 9th, 1943. The speaker is that well-known expert on all matters pertaining to immigration and other things, General George Patton. The occasion was the eve of the invasion of Sicily, and Patton was giving a little pep talk to his troops before they embarked on the ships for the invasion. And among the repeatable things that he said was the following passage. He said, "When we land, we will meet German and Italian soldiers, whom it is our honor and privilege to attack and destroy. Many of you have in your veins German or Italian blood, but remember that those ancestors of yours so loved freedom that they gave up home and country to cross the ocean in search of liberty. The ancestors of the people we shall kill tomorrow lacked the courage to make such a sacrifice and continued as slaves." Now, that is a trademark Patton idiom. But I submit to you that General Patton was there trading on a stock of very widely disseminated and deeply held images about who all of our immigrant forebears were. In this accounting, our immigrant ancestors were the most freedom-loving, entrepreneurial, democratic, democracy-seeking, cream of the crop of their old world societies, and they came here and by their presence made this the greatest country in the world by our own admission. And this is a standard folkloric understanding of what made immigration happen. It was the upwelling of the energies of these most the kinetic and dynamic members of old world societies who came here. So this is one very, very standard image, and I dare say, if we probe at it, explanation of the whole historical phenomenon of immigration. It's one that's deeply embedded in our national consciousness. Now, there's an alternative image, and I'm going to share a brief passage with you that represents this alternative. This came from the pen of a noted Stanford professor of 100 years ago by the name of Edward Ellsworth Ross. As Dick Atkinson and I were discussing earlier, Ross was canned by the first president of Stanford, David Starr Jordan, because of his advanced views on a number of subjects that have deeply offended Jane Lathrop Stanford, who was still around and making her influence felt. But this is Edward Ellsworth Ross speaking or writing about immigrants in 1910. He said, "Behold the new immigrants." Now, actually, he's using a phrase there that historians have adopted. The immigrants of his time, 1910, were thought to be new, as most people in this room will appreciate, because they came not from the Nordic, North European sites of the British and the Scandinavians and the Germans and so on, but they came from Southern and Eastern Europe. They were Catholic and Orthodox and Jewish. They came from the lower Danube basin and east of the Carpathians and so on. So that's who he's talking about. It might be noted in passing the people he's talking about are the parents of Patton's troops. But he said, "Behold the new immigrants as they walk down the gangplank. They are hirsute, low-browed, big-faced persons of obviously low mentality. They are out of place in black clothes and stiff collars, since clearly they belong in skins, in wattled huts, at the close of the Great Ice Age." Now, again, this is an image and an explanation of immigration that we're familiar with, just in our culture and our folklore. In this view, that little bit of doggerel that's on the base of the Statue of Liberty about the wretched refuse of your teeming shore is, in this perspective, an all-too-accurate description of who immigrants were. This is an explanation that tends to attach to people who've come a little more recently than the ones who had the privilege of catching an earlier boat. But we're familiar with this, and in this view, immigrants are blood-sucking parasites who come here and sap all the energy from the society that all the rest of us have already established, and they're job-stealing, culture-diluting threats to the whole American way of life. These are two very, very familiar images to us. I dare say the first one, Patton's, is more self-comforting and therefore a little more deeply held, I suppose, but we're familiar with both. Now, what I want to suggest to you is that both of these very popular perspectives on the whole question of immigration suffer from the same defect. Both of them essentially base their explanations, such as they are, of immigration on the factor of the character of the individual migrants and of their voluntary decisions to become migrants and come to this country. And I want to try to suggest to you a different perspective altogether that may, if we probe at it deeply, even constitute a foundation for a research agenda by reminding you that from the time of the discovery of the American continents in 1492 until a date of approximately 1820, give or take 5 or 10 years, the principal source of migrants to the New World as a whole, not just to the British North American colonies or the United States, but to the New World as a whole, was not Europe. It was Africa. Some 10 million Africans came to the New World from essentially the dawn of the 16th century down to the early 19th century. Now, it would make a mockery of our historical understanding of that great migration of 10 million souls to start explaining it in terms of the freedom-loving, democracy-seeking, entrepreneurial spirit of those migrants or of their wish to throw themselves on the mercies of the welfare state of its day in order to find in this these continents a cushier lives for them, life for themselves. We understand instinctively and correctly that's just an absolutely silly explanation. And what we understand, again, instinctively and correctly about that African migration is that it was largely involuntary in character, that it had to do with forces well beyond the control of the individual agency or will of the migrants themselves. So, too, I would like to suggest to you, should we think about that great European migration of 35 million people between 1820 and 1920, approximately 25 million of whom came in the few decades between the mid-1880s and the outbreak of World War I. That's that huge migratory wave is backloaded, as it were, to the very later phase of the whole pattern, with the bulk of persons arriving in the two or three decades at either side of the break of 1900. Now, that the sudden infusion of some 25 million people into this country in that period of time did not occur, it seems to me, again, this is intuitive if we think about it, because all of a sudden, 25 million Europeans had some sudden access of the entrepreneurial and freedom-loving spirit. They were put into motion by deeply operating forces within the dynamic of European society at the time, and it is to the sending societies that we should look for the most fundamental explanation of why this phenomenon occurred at such a scale, at such a specific moment in time. Now, two factors in particular, both of which have to do with the internal dynamics of European history, not with particularly with the dynamics of American history, go a long way toward explaining this phenomenon. The first is very simple, doesn't need to belabor the point. It is quite simply population growth. The population of Europe expanded phenomenally over the course of the 19th century. It doubled over the course of the century, even from about 200 million to something better than 400 million people between 1800 and 1900, even after we've netted out some 70 million people who went elsewhere, approximately half of whom came to the United States. But the other half of the migrants from Europe in the 19th century went other places, Canada, Australia, Argentina, Southern Africa, and so on. So already we're cued here to something that it is something other than just the attractive power of the American magnet which put these people in motion. It's something disruptive going on in European society. Population growth is the first and essential precondition for this. Europe could not get itself into the position of being a major exporter of people unless it had surplus people in the perception of the time to export. So population growth is the first and fundamental explanation of what's going on here. But the second, and I think more interesting for us, is a very complicated historical phenomenon, though we have a familiar name to refer to it. It's called the Industrial Revolution, an immensely complex process. But its basic effect was to disrupt traditional and stable ways of life and to make migrants, most of them internal migrants within their home countries in Europe, or at least within the European continent, out of people who had been for generations peasants, contadinos, subsistence farmers, or barely market entry farmers on the land. Now, there's a British economic historian who studied this in some details. His name is Brindley Thomas, in a book called Migration and Economic Growth. And I'm going to do you the great favor of distilling about 800 pages of Brindley Thomas's analysis into a couple of lapidary paragraphs. If you can imagine, if I were more high-tech, I'd have a map of Europe here to show you. But if you can imagine a map of Europe in your mind's eye, essentially Brindley Thomas's explanation goes like this. This is my summary of this very complicated analysis. If you draw a timeline across the face of Europe, the map of Europe, that traces the evolution of the Industrial Revolution, it begins in the British Isles in the late 18th century, moves on to in the Low Countries in Germany and Scandinavia in the early 19th century, and then makes its way as the decades go by through across into Central Europe, Eastern Europe, the Lower Danube Basin, down the Italian Peninsula, and so on. And then Brindley Thomas, in effect, does a second thing. He draws a second timeline across the map of Europe that traces the major sources of out-migration to the United States, in our case, over time. And lo and behold, the second line is, for all practical purposes, precisely congruent with the first line. And again, just a quick mental review of our own immigration history confirms this, that the first waves of migrants come first in the British Isles, first the English and Scots and Welsh, and then the Irish, then the Germans, and then later on in the century, the 19th century, Eastern Europeans, Poles, Russians, Italians, Yugoslavs, Bulgarians, and so on, the so-called new immigrants that Edward Ellsworth Ross was talking about in 1910. And Brindley Thomas's conclusion is this is not a coincidence. This is not just an accident. It's not a random association of events, that the Industrial Revolution, particularly when it first arrives in a given locale, works its most disruptive effects, moves people from countryside to city, from agricultural to industrial employment. And in that disruption, particularly in the early decades of the arrival of the Industrial Revolution at any given site, people are not everybody is able to be reabsorbed locally into urban and industrial sites and employment, and they become candidates for migration elsewhere. And indeed, that's what we see of people coming to the United States in those numbers. So this is to my mind at least, this is a pretty satisfactory macro level Of course, there are all kinds of exceptions, religious persecution and so on, but the most comprehensive explanation of why those millions of people got into motion in the 19th and early 20th century has to do with these combined effects of population explosion and the early impact of the Industrial Revolution. All right, so let's turn now to our second question. What happened to them once they got here? Now, again, this is an enormously complicated story, and many groups have their own particular stories within it. But I want to focus on a little bit, maybe a somewhat unorthodox aspect of this general phenomenon. And I'm reminded here of a story I like to tell about Gertrude Stein on her deathbed, attended by her faithful lifelong companion, Alice B. Toklas, who many of you will remember earned her own footnote in history as the person who came up with the recipe for Alice B. Toklas brownies. But anyway, Alice Toklas was attending Gertrude on her deathbed, and at some point, so the story goes, Gertrude Stein sat up, bolt upright in the bed, and she said, "Alice, what is the answer?" And Alice Toklas is said to have replied, "But Gertrude, what is the question?" And Gertrude Stein said, "Ah, that is the answer," and died. Now, I don't know if the story is true. I hope it is, because it's a great heuristic device to remind us that getting that question right is the first and most important task. Okay, I think the computer programmers refer to this principle as garbage in, garbage out. If we ask the wrong question, we're going to get a not very satisfactory answer. So getting the question right is the first and most important task. Now, I think the important question, the single most important question I think we can address to this, the history of American immigration 100 years ago or so, is, as I say, some people in this room might find this an unorthodox question, but I do think it's the central question, is why was it so successful? How was it that despite all the nativist and anti-immigrant stuff that we know about, and I don't mean to blink that away, I know about the American Protective Association, the Ku Klux Klan, and all the rest of it, but despite all that, it seems to me that at the end of the day, the thing that begs for an historical explanation about that earlier immigrant phenomenon is how did it go down so relatively well without more social disruption, without more violence? Why was it, to put it in terms of what I started out with, that George Patton could count reflexively on the patriotism and the commitment of his troops, who were, by and large, the sons of immigrants, on that beach in Tunisia in 1943. This is the thing, it seems to me, that needs explanation, is how did this society manage to absorb tens of millions of newcomers in a relatively short period of time, a long generation or so, from the 1880s to 1914, without more social disruption? And how did they make their way into the society in a way that's testified to by the presence of many of us in this room today? Now again, since my commission here is to take this satellite level view of things, I'm going to stay at that high altitude and just suggest three factors that, in my view, went a long way toward underwriting the relatively peaceful absorption of those millions of immigrants a century ago. The first of the three factors, quite simply, has to do with their numbers. Absolutely large, to be sure, 35 million over the century, 25 million at the tail end of the process. But the census of 1910, as it happens, is the census that shows the highest percentage of foreign-born ever in the United States. Many people in this room will know the number. It's 14.7%. Now, that's not a trivial number, but it has a property that's undeniable. It is decidedly a minority. So immigrants, just because of the scale of the society, immigrants never had the presence overall, all summed up, in the society that was sufficient to even hold out the possibility of a unified immigrant challenge to the dominant cultural institutions and practices. So the numbers, or the relative numbers of immigrants at any given time, I think is one factor that helps us understand why this process of absorption or assimilation went forward as relatively peacefully as it did. The second factor is, again, a kind of self-evident one. It has to do with the economic context in which all this happened. And again, as everybody in this room will appreciate and already understand, immigration is to a considerable extent a function of economic health, and particularly economic growth. And it turns out, yes, that most of those migrants arrived with the exception of a 3 or 4 year period in the 1890s, the famous depression of the 1890s, they arrived in periods not only of economic health, but of rapid economic growth and expansion. So that the accommodation of newcomers went forward without forcing nasty questions of redistribution of a relatively fixed supply of the things that everybody in the society was competing for and aspiring to. So economic growth, in this as in so many contexts in American history, was a kind of, if I can put it this way, a kind of preemptive solvent of possibly more confrontational and difficult social issues. The third factor that I think underwrote the relatively peaceful accommodation of all those folks a century ago is, again, a complicated business. I'll give it a label just to be able to refer to it later. I'm going to call it pluralism. And what I mean by that is that that immigrant stream that came 100 years ago or so was notable for its internal variety. People came from all kinds of different confessional associations, cultures, languages, historical backgrounds, and so on. Yes, they were for the most part all Europeans, but that's not a category that really meant much to them. Polish Jews and Czech Catholics and Greek Orthodox and Italian peasants had virtually nothing in common with one another, literally could not speak with one another in a common language. And they dispersed themselves, what's more, over a very, very large geographic area, essentially the entire northeast of the United States. And this meant that there, for any given individual immigrant group, there was no realistic prospect of maintaining their cultural patrimony intact for more than a generation or two. There simply wasn't the critical mass, the concentration of the dense community. There are some exceptions. Chicago is an exception to this day in some ways. But with a few exceptions like that, most immigrant groups face no practical strategic choice other than to somehow make their peace with the larger society. All right, so that's the historical rehearsal. Now, if I can take my remaining 4 or 5 minutes, whatever I have, to see what this might tell us about the present. The first and most obvious thing that anybody who's followed this line of thinking thus far will notice is that the sources of immigration today appear to be, and I stress appear to be, quite novel compared to what we've historically experienced. The top 10 contributor countries to the immigrant stream today are, in rank order, Mexico, China, the Philippines, India, Vietnam, El Salvador, Korea, Cuba, Canada, and the Dominican Republic. Now, that list has an obvious property. There's not a single European country on it. So this appears to be quite a dramatic change from what was happening a century ago. But if we understand historically what made migrants out of all those Europeans in the 19th and early 20th centuries, and compare that to what's going on today, we conclude that we are in the presence of a very familiar phenomenon. And if we take Mexico as the case in point, which is the principal country after all, so why not focus on it principally, Mexico indeed conforms to a pattern that is very similar to the pattern of Europe in the 19th century. It has been for a few generations experiencing very rapid population growth, and it has, particularly since World War II, been destabilized by the impact of the relatively early stages of its own industrial revolution. Underwritten by things like the Rockefeller Green Agriculture Project, the Green Revolution in Mexico, probably further exacerbated by NAFTA. But Mexico has been destabilized by the arrival of modern economic practices and institutions in a way that's quite comparable to what was happening in 19th century Europe. So if we ask what are the causes of today's migration, and particularly if we look to the disruptive things going on in the sending societies, Mexico in particular, we might take some comfort from this little history lesson that we are in the presence here of a reasonably familiar phenomenon, that people become migrants today for reasons that are quite comparable to the reasons why people became migrants in the past. All right, now what if we ask our second question in the present context is if we've satisfied ourselves that the causes of migration today are reasonably similar to the past, what's going to happen to today's migrants and to this society if this the immigration process continues at its present rate? Now, I hope you'll remember, I have particularly fond hope you'll remember, because it was only a few minutes ago I was talking about it, that I offered three explanations why the process of absorption of those millions of immigrants a century ago went forward so relatively successfully. Because of the relative numbers of people who were here, 14.7% maximum foreign-born 1910, because of the context of economic growth in which they arrived, and because of the plural and distributed character of the immigrant stream. So if those are our three key historical explanations of or answers to the question of why things went down reasonably well 100 years ago, how might those factors help us understand the present situation? Well, the numbers actually, though they're absolutely very high today, 30 million plus foreign-born in the United States, there are more immigrants in the United States today than there were people in the United States at the time of the American Civil War. But the absolute numbers are very high, no question about it, but the relative presence of immigrants in today's society is actually less than it was at the time of the Civil War, when immigrants were 13% of the population, and well under that 14.7% high point for foreign-born in 1910. So in relative terms, again, we confront, as we do in so many things, the scale of this society is a factor in understanding these kinds of phenomena, because immigrants today are approximately a little better than 11% of the present-day population of the United States. Again, it's not a trivial percentage by any means, and the absolute numbers are high, but we might take some comfort from the recognition that this society in the past has found the means and the resources and has been resilient enough to absorb immigrants on an even higher relative scale than we face today. So here's one point I think where history offers us a little bit of comfort. But if we look at the other two factors that I adduced a few minutes ago by way of explaining the way the earlier immigration process worked, here I think we have some occasion for pause. If we look at the economic context in which immigrants arrive today, there's a new element in the equation, and it's an element that actually was quite, interestingly probed in that earlier Academy study that Melvin referred to, The New Americans, published 9 years ago. And that has to do with what is both the real and perhaps even more importantly, the perceived fiscal cost of immigration today. This is a factor that did not really come into very sharp focus 100 years ago, partly because the capacity of the American state a century ago to provide social services was extremely limited. It's only in the New Deal and post-World War II eras that it's permissible to talk about anything resembling a welfare state such as it is in this country. So the amount of publicly provided social provision 100 years ago was absolutely minimal. Education was about it. So the issue of the fiscal cost of immigration simply didn't arise in anything resembling its present context. But as that Academy study a decade ago showed, in the state of California, its computation of the cost to native-born households of the immigrant presence was nearly $1,200 a year. That's the economic reality, the felt economic reality that underlay things like Prop 187 in this state in the last decade. So this is a factor in the economic situation today that simply didn't exist before, and where history can give us very little guidance about how to address it in a responsible way. Now, with respect to the third factor I mentioned a while ago, pluralism, the variegated and distributed character of that earlier immigrant stream, this is where, again, the Mexican case comes into particularly sharp focus for us, because the Mexican immigrant stream today has some characteristics for which we have, in our historical experience, virtually no precedent. It's a culturally, for all practical purposes, homogeneous group in considerable numbers. It has the social and political and cultural critical mass, if it wishes to, or if it does choose to do so, to insist to have, it's a plausible strategy for that community, should it choose to do so, to insist on some fundamental renegotiation of the terms of political and social integration in this country in a way that some analysts have compared to the character of Quebec within Canada. Some people have talked about the emergence of a Chicano Quebec in the American Southwest. Samuel Huntington in particular. Now, for my money, the Huntington analysis is
hugely alarmist and vastly overdrawn, but nevertheless, he is pointing to an indisputable historical fact that we have no, in our society's history, we have no precedent for the existence in the society of an immigrant group of such proportions and such internal cultural homogeneity, with its mother country immediately next door, with modern technology and communications making the constant refreshing of its cultural identity easy because of the association with that mother country in a way that the Europeans 100 years ago couldn't easily do, that this poses a different set of questions, it seems to me, for this society and for that community about how it might or might not be fully assimilated into the larger society. So this is a point, I think, where history brings us to the point of having to confront the fact that history cannot guide us on this particular issue, that we've got to be smarter and more clever than our forebears if we are going to negotiate this particular passage in our immigration history successfully. So I'll just stand here because I see Melvin looking at his watch. As all history presentations have to, at least at one point, mention Abraham Lincoln. So I'm going to close with a rather well-known remark of Lincoln's that was uttered in a different context, but I think is pertinent to the situation we face today. He said this in 1862 about the issue of slavery, and he was actually trying to persuade the Congress to agree to a program of compensated emancipation. But he said, "The dogmas of the quiet past are inadequate to the stormy present. The occasion is piled high with difficulty, and we must rise to the occasion. As our case is new, so must we think anew and act anew. We must disenthrall ourselves, and then we shall save our country." Thank you.
He was our warm-up guy. He did a great job, and he also did something that our speakers are going to emulate, and that is stay right on time. So I'm going to ask the speakers in the first panel to come up, and I will introduce you.